really even the will to impose French on the English, and there were just a lot more Englishmen than Normans. And I think it also made a big difference that the Normans adopted English identity so readily. By the late 12th century, certainly, they're comfortably bilingual. And they're headed, rather inevitably, on the path to being monolingual. And that's where the English today emphatically still are. So there's a trend away from French. By the 14th century, things that used to be written in French, like romances about knights and their deeds, they're now being written in English. And I'm going to talk about that sort of work later in the lecture. But you see another striking shift. Religious texts also start to be written in English. Now, they don't replace religious writing in Latin, far from it. But you get large numbers of religious texts written in English for the first time since the great Anglo-Saxon sermons of the early 11th century that we talked about many lectures ago. These kinds of texts in English had virtually disappeared after the Norman conquest, though we certainly know that churchmen are preaching in English. For example, in the late 12th century, we have an account of the abbot of the monastery of Bury St. Edmunds in Suffolk, Abbot Sampson. He was said to be able to preach in three languages, Latin, French, and English, though the English he spoke was the Norfolk English he had grown up with. And apparently, the difference even between Norfolk English and Suffolk English was quite apparent to Sampson's audience. But we don't have a written version of any of Sampson's homilies in English. It wasn't considered to be worth writing them down. In the 14th century, though, you see full-scale religious works written in English, and they're designed to be read by an educated audience. And the most famous of these is The Vision of Piers Plowman by William Langland. We don't know a lot about the author. Langland was apparently a priest from the West Midlands. Somehow he had acquired the education needed to write this very complicated work. It's an allegorical work. The characters in the story have names like Reason and Truth. But the main character is a simple plowman who really stands for everyman. And in the story, the author has a series of visions, and they all amount to a kind of social commentary on the evils of the day. You get criticism of corruption within the church, for example, of the kind we were talking about in the last lecture when we talked about Wycliffe and the Lollards. This text is a powerful indicator of how prevalent that sort of criticism was. But you also get a beautiful statement of the redemptive value of the work performed in this life, the daily toil of somebody like Piers the Plowman. He's a humble soul, but he's better than anybody else in the poem. Now, the poem itself is not advocating revolution, but some of the sentiments in the poem were certainly picked up on by the rebels in 1381. John Ball, the rebel priest of 1381, referred to Piers Plowman quite explicitly. Now, Langland would not have approved, but I think it's a sign of how English is coming into its own that you have this text circulating widely enough that people can be reading it, referring to it, and interpreting it to suit their own political agenda. Now, the other great area of religious writing in which English was used in the 14th century was in mystical writings. This was a great age for mystics in the European church generally, and England is no exception. Now, these mystics are mostly solitary figures. They're preoccupied with exploring the direct connection between God and the soul of the believer via a sort of mystical union. And again, this is a little bit like what Wycliffe is doing. You're focusing less on the institutional church, more on the individual believer and his or her relationship with God. Now, the best known of these mystics is Dame Julian of Norwich. And incidentally, many mystics were women, and I think the idea of this direct connection to God is probably very appealing to women, since officially they're shut out of the institutional hierarchy. So Dame Julian is an anchoress, and the male equivalent for that would be an anchorite. And that's similar to a hermit. Like hermits, anchorites and anchoresses lived in solitude, but unlike hermits, usually they lived in a setting where they're otherwise surrounded by other people. They would literally be walled into a cell in a parish church. You might actually build a little cell onto the end of a parish church for them to live in, and they would promise never to leave. But people could talk to them through a sort of opening in the wall. So they were both part of the community and not part of the community. They had a kind of liminal or borderline status, and this could make them seem like good points of contact with the divine. So Dame Julian is one of these people. She lived in the late 14th and early 15th centuries in the town of Norwich in Norfolk, and she was attached to the Church of St. Julian, and that's where she gets her name from. We don't really know her actual name. When Dame Julian was about 30 years old, she fell ill and believed she was dying. And at that time, she had a series of direct revelations from God, and she wrote them down. And this may be the first work written in English by a woman. And she called these revelations showings. And the focus of the showings is the love of God for the individual believer. There's a very famous tagline in the showings. Dame Julian says that she has been assured, "All shall be well. All manner of things shall be well." It's a rather optimistic theology. And Dame Julian had company in this optimism about the union of the soul with God. There were other mystics, like Richard Rawl. He was a mid-14th century hermit from Yorkshire, and he wrote a work called The Fire of Love, and it described how his soul was united with God, and apparently this process proceeded in three stages. First, he got a physical warmth in the body, then a wonderful sense of sweetness, and finally, he heard a heavenly music that would accompany him as he chanted the Psalms in his hermitage. Now, I'll just mention one other mystical work. This one is by an anonymous author. It's called The Cloud of Unknowing. It was written in the late 14th century as a kind of advice manual for students. So by definition, it's going to be for potential clerics. But the text warns students not to focus so much on seeking God through learned works. Forget all that. Empty the mind. Approach God directly through blind love. And that's where the title comes from, The Cloud of Unknowing. Knowledge is not the key to union with God. Now, this would be a fairly severe criticism of the kind of philosophical argumentation that was being taught in the schools at that point. So if you look at the mystical works together, they do seem to dovetail with Wycliffe's criticisms of the church. But with one big difference, these mystics don't deny the validity of the institutional church. They merely offer a sort of alternative path. Still, the fact is you have these texts available in English, and that's part of the point. You have a direct connection to God. You are experiencing God in your own language, not in Latin, not in a language you have to acquire with great labor and study. And so I think language is a little bit part of their theology. It's very much building on a new self-confidence. These English authors believe that they can and should be expressing themselves in English. Now, I just want to touch on one more religious work in English before we move on to more secular texts. And it's definitely in a class by itself. These mystical works we've been talking about have a lot in common with each other, but this work I want to talk about now is unique. It's called The Book of Marjorie Kemp. And unlike the mystics we've talked about, the author of this book was herself illiterate. So this is the work as told to some other person or persons. There seem to have been several scribes involved. Now, the text concerns the spiritual and material travails of Marjorie Kemp. And Marjorie is not very mystical. She's occasionally exasperating, but ultimately she's rather endearing. So who is she? She lived in King's Lynn in Norfolk in the late 14th and early 15th centuries. She had visions, certainly, but they tended to be of a very domestic nature, not the kinds of very ethereal visions that the mystics had. They reflected her rather bourgeois concerns. She's the wife of a prominent tradeswoman in King's Lynn. She had born 14 children. And Marjorie actually visited Dame Julian in Norwich at one point to discuss the visions, and Dame Julian gave them a sort of a qualified seal of approval. One gets the sense she had a few reservations. Now, the thing that Marjorie was really known for was going on pilgrimage. She went all over the place, within England and overseas. She went to Rome, she went to Norway, she went to the Holy Roman Empire. And on these trips, she often made her fellow pilgrims uncomfortable because she had the gift of tears, you know, weeping in sorrow for, you know, sins and that sort of thing. Apparently, she couldn't really turn it off. And the incessant weeping got on other people's nerves. Now, it can be easy to poke a little bit of fun at Marjorie, but she's quite important, I think, in a number of respects. She's probably the first English woman to write her own autobiography. She's a laywoman, a married woman with children, although we are told that she did live a chaste life with her husband after the 14 children. Her preoccupation with her own spiritual life, I think, gives us a sense of how important these questions are to ordinary lay people in this period. And Marjorie called enough attention to herself to be charged several times with unorthodoxy by the church authorities. But each time, she stood her ground and proved her innocence. She had grit. Now, if I had to try to think of anybody even remotely comparable to Marjorie, I end up thinking of a fictional character from about the same time, Chaucer's Wife of Bath. They're alike in being women you couldn't ignore. Otherwise, there are important differences. Marjorie Kemp struggled against sexual desire. The Wife of Bath didn't. She happily gave in to it. I'm going to switch gears and talk about fiction then in the 14th century, and I'll get to Chaucer, but I want to talk first in general terms about English poetry in the 14th century, and then we'll get to Chaucer. So first, some general points. In the 14th century, the west and northwest of England seem to have produced a kind of center of literary excellence. This is the area that produces the most important narrative poems of the period. And we can tell this by features of the dialect that mark the poems as coming from this region of England. The poems are written in alliterative verse. This is the kind of verse we saw used in Beowulf. That is, the lines have repeated initial sounds that kind of knit the line together. And each line would be divided into two half lines, with a pause or caesura in the middle. Now, this is a legacy that comes very clearly from the native English poetic tradition. But here comes an interesting wrinkle. These alliterative lines are now being grouped into rhyming stanzas, just like in the French romances. So you've got alliteration and rhyme both at once. And this is a pretty good indication that what we've got here is a blending of the English and the French, and there's a new art form that results. And you can see this blending very clearly in the appearance of Arthurian romances written in English. And we talked about this in an earlier lecture. You'll remember back in the 12th century, these start out being written in France, though the English audiences also love them. Now they're being written in English, and we get a masterpiece like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which I talked about before. But there were also other very sophisticated narrative poems that used this elaborate mixture of alliteration and rhyme. And one such poem is called The Pearl. And it's interesting that it's possible the author of The Pearl is also the author of Sir Gawain. Now, at any rate, the texts appear together in the manuscript, and scholars see a lot of stylistic similarities between them. So what is The Pearl about? That's a very good question, and nobody's completely sure. It seems to be sort of allegorical, sort of visionary. We don't know exactly what it means. In the poem, it's a very complicated poem. There are 101 stanzas. They have 12 lines each, and there's a very complicated rhyme scheme. In this poem, we meet a narrator who is distraught at having lost a pearl. And we're not sure if this is an actual pearl or some sort of symbol. He falls asleep, and he wakes up beside a stream. On the other side of the stream, he sees a maid who he identifies as the pearl. Now, it's possibly significant that pearl is the English translation of the name Margaret, which is very common in this period. It might mean something. The maid replies that she is not the pearl herself, but she is entitled to wear the pearl because she has been washed in the blood of the Lamb. That is, she has sought salvation in the redemptive sacrifice of Christ, and she tells the narrator to do the same. Sell everything, buy the pearl of great price mentioned in the Gospels. Then the narrator asks if he can go to the heavenly city of Jerusalem, but the maid tells him that's forbidden. He can, however, see a vision of the city. The vision appears across the river, but when the narrator plunges into the water to try to reach the city, he wakes up. Now, presumably, he's learned something. He's been spiritually edified. Certainly, the audience of the poem has been treated to a poetic masterpiece. Now, whether or not the poet of the Pearl and the poet of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight were the same person, the fact is, both works are anonymous. But that's emphatically not the case with the author that we're going to spend the rest of the lecture on, Geoffrey Chaucer. He's the greatest writer of the English Middle Ages, and the first one about whom we actually know quite a bit. He was born about 1342, and he died in 1400. He was the son of a vintner in London, a wine merchant, and he held various positions in English royal service, and that means he left something of a paper trail. We've talked several times about how administrative records are getting more extensive over time, and here's an instance where that's really helpful. We actually have nearly 500 written references to Chaucer. We know he went on several foreign delegations during the Hundred Years' War. He traveled to France, to Spain, to Flanders, to Italy. Eventually, he held several important government posts, including controller of the Port of London. And in 1386, he was even elected to Parliament. So he had a very busy public career. But along with this public career, he produced a very impressive literary output. In addition to his masterpiece, The Canterbury Tales, which we're going to talk about, he also translated Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy into English. Now, this is the same work that King Arthur had translated in the late 9th century. Clearly, it was time for an updated version. Chaucer also wrote a long poem about the Trojan War, called Troilus and Cressida, and many other shorter works. But he's really known for the Canterbury Tales. Now, the literary conceit in this work, the framing device, is that you have a group of pilgrims, and they all want to go to Canterbury to visit the shrine of St. Thomas Becket. As we saw in an earlier lecture, Becket had become an overnight sensation when he was martyred in 1170, and his tomb was the most popular domestic pilgrimage destination in England, even 2 centuries later when Chaucer was writing. So you have 29 pilgrims from all walks of life, and they all happen to gather at an inn in Southwark, across the river from London, on the south bank of the Thames, and it's called the Tabard Inn. Now, there's some grumbling among these ill-assorted guests, until the innkeeper proposes a wager. They'll all go on pilgrimage together, including the innkeeper. That makes 30 pilgrims. Along the way, each pilgrim will tell 2 tales on the outward journey and 2 tales on the way back. And the one who everybody agrees tells the best tale, he'll win a free dinner at the expense of all the rest. Now, alas, Chaucer never completely finished this scheme. We should have thus 120 stories, but we only have 24. We don't even have 1 for each pilgrim, let alone 4 for each pilgrim. But we should be very grateful for the ones we have. Now, the idea of strangers who were thrown together by chance who then decide to take turns telling tales to pass the time, that's not Chaucer's own invention. This is exactly the same format you see in the Decameron by Boccaccio. There you have people taking refuge from the plague in Florence, and they're also telling stories to pass the time. And it's even possible that Chaucer met Boccaccio when he was in Italy. We're not sure. But Chaucer does something new with his group of pilgrims. He uses them as a vehicle for social commentary on English men and women of all social classes and walks of life. The social status of the pilgrims is reflected very well in the tales they choose to tell. They tell different kinds of tales depending on who they are. The characters of very high status, like the knight, they tell very elevated, very refined tales about courtly adventures and chivalry. The characters of very low social status, like the miller and the reeve, they tell rather earthy stories with salty language you might not want to use in mixed company. Now, some of these tales borrow very freely from foreign genres. like the French fabliau. That's the origin of the earthy stories that I just mentioned. But Chaucer is such a master of the English language that it all comes out seeming uniquely English. Now, I've mentioned the way in which Chaucer uses language to depict social status, different styles of story, different language. That's a subtle way of commenting on social mores. But he also does this very directly, right at the beginning of the work. And this is the part of the work that historians have the most fun with, I think, because everything is very out in the open. The poet is pretty much telling you what he thinks. And here I'm talking about the very famous prologue to the Canterbury Tales. A great portion of the prologue is taken up with setting the stage for the poem by introducing the characters. And the poet does this by giving us a series of capsule biographies. And we get his description of the pilgrims' physical features, of course, but also of their manners and behavior. And some of the pilgrims are clearly more admirable than others. And here I think you get a clue to what English people are thinking about different classes of people in society in the 14th century, or at least what Chaucer thought about them. And one very striking theme, I think, is the anti-clericalism that we noticed at the time of the Peasants' Revolt in 1381. That has by no means gone away. It seems to be ingrained in these English stereotypes. And you see this very strongly in the portraits of the friar and the summoner. A summoner is somebody who summoned people to the ecclesiastical courts. This is not somebody you wanted to have knocking on your door. But I'll just talk about the friar here. The friar is portrayed as a very dissipated sort. Certainly he's not following his vows very strictly. And he's very, very greedy. So I'll just give you a taste of this in modern translation. Sweetly he heard his penitence at shrift, with pleasant absolution for a gift. So he's mercenary. He's selling absolution from sins. He's also overly fond of parties. He knew the taverns well in every town. But one of the most damning things about the friar is that he actually has contempt for the poor he's supposed to be serving. He doesn't want to deal with beggars. It was not fitting with the dignity of his position, dealing with a scum of wretched lepers. Nothing good can come of commerce with such slum and gutter dwellers, but only with the rich and victual sellers. So this is a very damning indictment. We have a very strong contrast, though, between these very negative characters and the depiction of characters like the knight and the yeoman. They get a very favorable description, and even the plowman. And here I think we see some striking resemblances to Piers Plowman. We get the idea of the simple labor of the peasants held up as a kind of ideal. So this is what Chaucer's plowman sounds like. He was an honest worker, good and true, living in peace and perfect charity, and as the gospel bade him, so did he. Now, I've left my favorite character for last, though I've mentioned her once before in the lecture, and that's the wife of Bath. She's probably one of the most famous female characters in all of literature, and one of the charming things about her is that she is very much in love with herself, or at least she's very interested in her own story, kind of like Marjorie Kemp. And the funny thing about the wife of Bath, and here Chaucer is very much playing with stereotypes of women as being very, very talkative, is that she has a very famous prologue, and it's essentially an autobiography. We find out all about her five husbands, how they treated her, how she treated them, what she likes in a husband, what she thinks of marriage in general. And this goes on and on and on. And when we finally get to the end of the prologue and to the beginning of her tale, it turns out that the tale is a lot shorter than the prologue was. So Chaucer is having a lot of fun with the wife of Bath. She's definitely the character in the text who comes most vividly to life. And I think that's a good way to end our survey of the rise of English in the 14th century, because it really is the story of a language coming to life, coming into its own, claiming the attention of the educated public for the first time in centuries. Now, England is still a multilingual country. It would continue to be for a long time. Latin was going to be the indispensable language of the church and of learned discourse generally for hundreds of years more. In the 17th century, Sir Isaac Newton wrote his great work, including the famous Three Laws of Motion. He wrote that in Latin. And French is still useful for the upwardly mobile. It's still, for some people, one of those polite accomplishments that it's quite helpful to have, and it's essential for lawyers. Law French is going to be used in the royal courts down to the 17th century. But by that point, it's mostly degenerated into jargon. So there's still Latin and French around, but English is on the ascendant. And a sign of this is the position of English kings with regard to French. The kings, of course, are at the top of the social hierarchy, and French lasts longest at the royal court. Richard II is the first English king who had to learn French as a second language. Apparently, his French was very good, but it wasn't native. And though English kings officially claimed the throne of France down till 1801, they never went back to speaking French. In our next lecture, we're going to look at the later years of that monarch who spoke very good French for an Englishman, but we're going to see that his linguistic skills didn't compensate for his lack of political skills. We're going to look at the deposition and death of Richard II.
Lecture 30, The Deposition of Richard II.
Welcome back. We ended our last lecture talking about Richard II, how he was the first English king who had to learn French as a second language. We're going to spend this lecture looking at the reign of Richard II, and it's a very troubled reign. We've seen already that it starts off with the peasants' revolt, but that was by no means the last of Richard's troubles. The rest of the reign was dominated by power struggles. These power struggles were similar to those that occurred during the reign of Edward II in a few ways. You have access to patronage, the ability to influence royal policy. These are certainly major issues, as they had been in earlier struggles between the king and his barons. But things were different in Richard's reign in a very important respect. Parliament is now far more powerful than it had been earlier in the 14th century. The wars in France and the need to get Parliament to vote taxes to pay for them, that had led to a huge rise in the influence of Parliament. And things had gone so far by the end of Edward III's reign that in 1376, Parliament gained the right to impeach royal officers. That is, they could get rid of officers they disagreed with. And this is something that opponents of various kings had been trying to accomplish for a long time. So the balance of power has shifted a bit from the king to Parliament. And during Richard's reign, Parliament becomes an instrument whereby political enemies are going to go after each other in a very vicious way. Earlier baronial struggles, barons had been killed in battle with one another or with the king. During Richard's reign, you start to see barons executed by order of Parliament. Politics becomes deadly. Now, one reason for this alarming development is that some of the barons themselves have grown far more powerful. This period, the mid to late 14th century, is a time when magnates are expanding and consolidating their power. Partly, this is an outgrowth of developments in Edward III's reign. On a very practical level, it's the result of the fact that Edward III had so many sons. They all founded important families with baronial titles. And so there are quite a few leading magnates out there who are closely related to the royal family. And this means they have significant resources and significant social clout. In addition, among the rest of the baronage, you have stricter inheritance customs coming in, and these are devised to try to keep estates together. Some estates are now being entailed in tail mail. Now, what does that mean, entailed in tail mail? It means that if there are no sons in the family, the estate doesn't go to the daughters. It goes to the nearest male relative. Now, why would this be? If daughters inherit, the custom is that the inheritance would be divided equally between them, and so that would tend to dissipate the holdings of the estate. But if it goes to a male, it can stay intact. Now, incidentally, this is the legal device that features in the plot of Jane Austen's novel, Pride and Prejudice, The Bennet sisters don't stand to inherit their father's estate because the estate is entailed. Now, what this means, what these new legal devices mean, is that the large noble estates are not being continually broken up. In fact, they're getting larger because of marriage alliances. And the result is you have a few very rich, very powerful magnates, and they can dominate politics in England simply because of their wealth. Now, one of the things they're doing with their wealth is hiring large retinues of private soldiers. And this phenomenon is often referred to by historians as bastard feudalism. Now, of course, nobody calls it that in the 14th century because you don't even have the word feudalism yet. But the idea here is that in earlier times, you have lords granting lands to their followers in exchange for military service. Now you have lords paying salaries. They're granting money in exchange for service. Now, recently, this whole idea of bastard feudalism has been attacked, at least the idea that it's new in this period, the 14th century. Scholars have tracked this very far back. You have nobles hiring household troops all the way back to the 12th century. But I think the essential point for our purposes is that by the time of Richard II's reign, you just have a lot of these people around, these rich, powerful nobles with significant private military resources behind them. And this obviously is going to tend to tip the power balance between the king and the nobles a bit more in favor of the nobles. Now, the explosive dynamic in Richard's reign is that Richard wants to push back. He sees that the king has lost power to the parliament. He's lost power to the nobles. He wants to reverse course. He wants to restore the authority of the crown, dial back the clock to a time before the power of the king was so constrained by parliament. Let's see how well he succeeded. First, I think it helps to know a little bit about what Richard was like. We've already seen he was personally brave. We saw that at the time of the Peasants' Revolt. But he just never fit the tenor of the times. He didn't seem to be the right king for the right moment in English history. For one thing, even though he's the son of the Black Prince and the grandson of Edward III, both very famous military commanders, he is not very interested in warfare himself. And in fact, most of his 22-year reign really constitutes a lull in the fighting between England and France. There were many reasons for this, but the English public wanted victory, and Richard did not deliver it, so that told against him. Richard was also not the kind of king who liked fighting in tournaments or other popular kinds of royal pursuits. He's a more sensitive sort, an introspective sort. He liked art and literature. He was a fairly knowledgeable artistic patron. I also don't think it helped his popularity that he tended to overdo the pomp and the glitz associated with kingship. He made a very big deal out of the importance of royal anointing, a ceremony that marked out kings as having a quasi-priestly character. He displayed the sun on all his banners, the idea being that he himself was the sun. Richard instituted all sorts of new ceremonies at court associated with his everyday activities. So everything got more elaborate, and there was more and more distance between the monarch and his people, and none of this is going to tend to lead Richard's people to want to fight for him when the time comes. Now, we have to remember, of course, that Richard takes the throne when he's 10 years old. And for the first few years of the reign, he's shielded somewhat by his advisors, especially his powerful uncle, John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster. You'll remember John of Gaunt was one of the major targets of the rebels in 1381. They believed that it was John of Gaunt, really, and not the young king who was responsible for royal policy. But already, the young king is beginning to steer an independent course. He's building an inner circle of advisors who are directly loyal to him, and he's ignoring the advice of the other barons. And this is the same dynamic that led to problems under Henry III and under Edward II, and it's going to cause trouble again under Richard. The first big issue to arise is the handling of the war with France. Everybody knew things weren't going well. We saw at the end of our lecture on Edward III's reign that most of the English gains in the war had evaporated by the time Richard took the throne. Now, a lot of money had been spent on the war, And rumors went around that some of the money was ending up in the pockets of the king's favorites, or possibly some of it was even ending up paid out as bribes to the enemies of the English. This was one palatable way of explaining so many English defeats. Maybe it's due to treachery and mismanagement. Parliament also attacked the whole management of the king's finances. Now, in 1384, two of Richard's favorites were accused of financial irregularities. This infuriated the king. Instead of investigating the complaints, Richard punished the accusers. In 1385, Parliament asked for an annual review of the accounts of the royal household. Richard refused to put this into effect. He was blocking every avenue Parliament tried to use to regulate the financial affairs of the kingdom. And naturally, this caused tremendous frustration, because by this point, Parliament feels a great deal of ownership in the king's finances. A lot of his money is their money. Now, when Parliament assembled in the fall of 1386, they demanded the dismissal of the treasurer and of the chancellor, Michael de la Pole. Pole had started life as a merchant's son, but he caught the king's eye, and Richard made him Earl of Suffolk. The House of Commons blamed Pole for some of the recent losses in the French War, and they wanted to get rid of him. And the king made a defiant reply. He told the Parliament that he would not dismiss a scullion from his kitchen at their request. And that's pretty much the tone Richard took with Parliament. And predictably, it didn't go over very well. The Parliament reminded the king that there was a precedent in recent times for getting rid of a king who refused to govern according to the laws of the land. Now, they're talking, of course, about Richard's own great-grandfather, Edward II, whom Parliament had deposed. Richard gave in. And Richard also had to give in to strict controls on his freedom to run his own finances as he saw fit. A council was appointed to oversee revenues and expenses, called the Commission Council. But the king did everything he could not to cooperate with the council, and he took steps to try to get rid of it. He convened a great council of royal judges, and from these judges he solicited legal opinions on whether the Parliament really had the right to impeach royal officials without the king's consent. Now, these royal judges are hardly impartial. They owe their jobs to the king. And to nobody's surprise, they declared the actions of the Parliament illegal, and they ruled that the sentence imposed on Chancellor Pole was erroneous, and they said the king could dissolve the Parliament at will. What's more, the judges said that the actions of those who had forced the king to accept the Commission Council were tantamount to treason. Essentially, the judges are pushing back against more than a century of developments that had increasingly hemmed in the power of the kings to act without restraint. The judges are restating the maximum case for the royal prerogative. But Richard's opponents were not cowed. They felt they had to act because this very broad definition of treason is a serious threat to anybody who opposed the king on matters of policy of any kind. The crime of treason brought with it the forfeiture of property, so it would affect not just the accused, but his whole family. So in the fall of 1387, several barons charged five of the king's favorites, including Pole, with an appeal or charge of treason of their own. Now, for that reason, these barons were called the Lords Appellant because of the appeal that they charged. The charge was encroaching royal power, and that just meant expanding the royal prerogative without justification. Now, it's not really any more legally sound than the king's definition of treason, but that's where politics have wound up. The king and the Parliament are reduced to accusing each other's supporters of treason. Now, Richard bought himself some time. He promised that the five accused would appear in Parliament to answer the charges. But meanwhile, one of the five accused, Robert de Vere, was leading a royal army from Cheshire in the west towards London to rescue the king from Parliament. The appellants went to meet de Vere's army at Radcot Bridge in Oxfordshire, and they dispersed it. They dispersed the royal army. And then the appellants proceeded towards London, and Richard was at their mercy. Incidentally, some new barons had joined the ranks of the appellants at Radcot Bridge. Henry Bolingbroke, the son of John of Gaunt, and Thomas Mowbray, Earl of Nottingham. We'll have more to say about these two very shortly. So in 1388, the Parliament met that was to decide the fate of the accused favorites of the king. And this Parliament became known as the Merciless Parliament. And the name pretty much tells us what happened. So there are five lords appellant, five accusers by this point, Bolingbroke and Nottingham, and also the earls of Gloucester, Arundel, and Warwick. And they entered the Parliament arm in arm, dressed in cloth of gold. Clearly, they want to make a big impression. Now, there are some legal difficulties over the appeal, but the lords appellant get around these by articulating the principle that Parliament, when it acts as a court, is supreme over all other courts. All five of the accused were condemned, although only one of them was physically present. The other four had fled. Two were ultimately executed, and of course all five lost their property. And a number of minor officials of the king were also executed, and this was the case despite the fact that there was some sentiment in their favor in the House of Lords. It was the House of Commons that was pressing for the executions. And I think it's very significant that the Commons is successful in winning the point. The political classes as a whole are very much opposed to the king's administration, and the Lords don't feel it's going to be safe to hold out against the Commons on this point. So what are the effects of the Merciless Parliament? Basically, the bitterness caused by these executions overshadows the rest of the reign. But for the moment, the whole country seems to catch its breath. For a few years, both Parliament and the king trod a bit more carefully. They're pulling back from the brink of chaos. The royal administration tries harder to conciliate Parliament, and the king's enemies back off as well. But tensions were never very far from the surface. In 1394, Richard lost his queen, Anne of Bohemia. They had been married for more than a decade, but the marriage was childless. The king, though, was passionately devoted to Anne. He never had any known mistresses. And he was so distraught when she died that he had the manor house at Sheen, where she breathed her last breath, razed to the ground. And at her funeral in Westminster Abbey, the Earl of Arundel, one of the lords appellant, apparently showed insufficient respect for the corpse of the queen, and King Richard struck him across the face in full sight of all the mourners. The earl was so worried about his position that he solicited and obtained a formal pardon for his role in the Merciless Parliament. Now, clearly, everyone at the apex of the political scene in England was nervous. And the Lords Appellant had a reason to worry, because the king began gathering a new group of royal favorites, far more formidable than the group that had been destroyed by the Merciless Parliament. He attracted young noblemen, people with more of an independent power base than his earlier supporters. But he also recruited men with parliamentary experience. He wanted their expertise in dealing with Parliament. The king is trying to learn from his earlier failures and to insulate himself from the kinds of attacks he had suffered from earlier. And the king's fortunes rose in the mid-1390s for two other reasons, both of them having to do with foreign policy. One was a change in relations with France. There had been a truce since 1389, and peace negotiations had been dragging on ever since. And they still couldn't agree on a final peace, but the two sides did strike a 28-year truce. And for Richard, the most important part of the agreement is that he would marry the young daughter of the King of France, Princess Isabella. She was only 6 at the time, but Richard himself was not yet 30. There was time yet to beget an heir. And the most crucial thing is her dowry, 800,000 francs. And this is going to give Richard some independence from Parliament. He's not going to need to ask them for money, and he definitely wants that. Now, I want to say one more thing about this marriage agreement, and it tells us, I think, how tense things are in English politics. King Richard gave the negotiators of the agreement the power to reduce the dowry demand if, In exchange, the French king and his uncles would promise to support Richard if the need arose. So here we see the King of England actually soliciting the King of France to help him against his own English subjects. Now, this never made it into the final terms of the agreement, but it's a pretty powerful indication of how insecure Richard felt. Now, the other foreign policy development that I want to touch on briefly took place actually just before the marriage treaty was negotiated. And this is Richard's one big success as a military commander. And it happens in Ireland. We haven't really talked about Ireland since we discussed the Angevin Empire and Henry II's conquest of Ireland. In the two centuries since, the English had established settlements in Ireland, but they'd never really conquered the country completely. And there were still many native Irish chieftains and kings who exercised authority in their own local areas, pretty much without interference from the English royal government. And in the 14th century, the English settlers had actually been losing ground. Areas that had been solidly English were once again being taken over by native Irish rulers. And this development is often called the Gaelic Resurgence. Now, during Richard's reign, one of these native Irish rulers had become especially powerful. His name was Art McMurrow, and he ruled part of the area just south of Dublin, so he was poised to strike at the heart of the English royal administration there. And his attacks were getting very brazen, and in 1394, King Richard decided to go to Ireland in person to teach Art McMurrow a lesson. And the king met with considerable success. He brought a large army over to Ireland, and he did manage to get Art McMurrow to submit formally to his rule, along with several other very important native chieftains. This was a serious morale booster for the king. But we need to keep in mind that when a guy like Art McMurrow submits to royal authority, he doesn't necessarily mean the same thing that the king thinks he means. And this is going to come back to haunt Richard later. But now we have Richard by 1397. He's got fairly substantial, apparent foreign policy achievement to his credit, and he has a large infusion of French cash. And it's at this moment, when the king is stronger than he's ever been at any point in his reign, that the House of Commons presents a petition by a member named Thomas Haxey designed to rein in the king's expenditures. This is, of course, an age-old complaint. But now, the king is much better prepared to meet such an attack. He has cultivated allies in the House of Lords. And the Lords arraign Haxey for treason and convict him. And furthermore, the Lords declare that if anybody excites the Commons to go after the king, that will be considered treason. And this is a shot across the bow for the king's enemies. And more was to come. The king moved against three of the Lords appellant, the Earls of Warwick, Arundel, and Gloucester. By the way, Gloucester is the king's own uncle. A carefully chosen group of pro-royal lords accuses the three earls of treason for their actions at the time of the Merciless Parliament, which was now, of course, a decade in the past. The pardon that Arundel had taken out after the episode at the Queen's funeral was solemnly revoked. The trials went forward. Warwick cracked. He confessed his guilt and was exiled to the Isle of Man in the Irish Sea, which is a fairly terrible fate for somebody used to being at the center of English politics. Arundel was sentenced to death. Gloucester died in prison in Calais. Probably he was murdered on Richard's orders. And the estates of the three condemned men were, of course, confiscated. Now, you may have noticed that only three of the appellants were condemned, but there had originally been five. The two others, Henry Bolingbroke and Thomas Mowbray, had apparently switched sides. They actually helped the king to get the convictions of the other three, and they were duly rewarded. Bolingbroke was made Duke of Hereford, and Mowbray was made Duke of Norfolk. But we're not done with this pair of vacillating noblemen yet. In the meantime, Richard took steps to consolidate his gains. In 1398, he forced Parliament to grant him a lifetime grant of a tax on wool. And this meant he wasn't going to have to keep renegotiating it with Parliament all the time. The king also had that pro-royal statement by the royal judges from 1387, the one about the king's prerogative, he had that made into official law. So there was going to be no more debate about whether these were just legal opinions. They're the law of the land. And the king also forced all of his critics from the crisis of 1387 to 88 to pay an indemnity to be readmitted to his good graces. And this included anybody who had ridden in arms against the king. This provision was interpreted so broadly that it covered 17 entire counties. And these counties had to pay 1,000 marks per shire, and they had to put their seals on blank charters, pledging themselves and their goods to the king as guarantees of their good behavior. So he could essentially fill them in any way he wanted to later on. And this is obviously a very scary weapon for the king to have at his command. And it added considerably to the general feeling of unease in England. Now we've arrived essentially at the state of affairs in England at the beginning of Shakespeare's play, Richard II. What followed, the whole series of events that led to Richard's deposition and death, it's really all fallout from the struggles of 1387 to 88 and of the revenge that the king had taken for the crisis. In January of 1398, Henry Bolingbroke appeared in Parliament before the king to accuse Thomas Mowbray of treason. Supposedly, Mowbray had told Bolingbroke that he figured the king was going to act against the two of them for their part in the merciless Parliament. Remember, these two had switched sides. Mowbray may have been figuring that the king was still going to come after them. Mowbray denied that he had said any such thing, and since the proofs were insufficient, the matter was scheduled to be decided by a judicial duel. And this is how points of honor were settled between noblemen. So the duel was set to be held at Coventry on September 16th. Bolingbroke and Mowbray appeared fully armed in the lists, and then the king threw down his baton to stop the combat. Instead of allowing it to go forward, he banished both men. I think Mowbray had had the right idea. The king had been intending to move against them. Now they've given him the excuse, and his revenge for the merciless Parliament was complete. And Richard went farther. By the terms of the order of banishment, the exiled lords were supposed to be able to draw on their revenues in England to support them overseas. But a few months after Bolingbroke left England, his father, John of Gaunt, died. This should have made Bolingbroke Duke of Lancaster, but there was no way Richard wanted him to inherit all that wealth and prestige. The king and his advisors managed to devise a very dubious legal provision that allowed them not only to block Bolingbroke from inheriting his father's lands, but also allowed them to take the whole inheritance into royal hands. The king thus felt very secure. He was rid of all his enemies. So now is a good time to revisit an earlier scene of triumph, Ireland, because, of course, the situation there had deteriorated. Art McMurrough had gone back on his word. He had actually surprised and killed the king's lieutenant in Ireland, the Earl of March, who happened also to be King Richard's cousin. And Richard wanted to restore order, so he set off for Milford Haven in Wales with a substantial force. Now, Richard's decision to go to Ireland in the spring of 1399 is one of the most famous political blunders in history. He left a country in ferment. The king may have thought he was now safely rid of his enemies, but in reality, the way he treated Bolingbroke really spooked people who had previously been indifferent to political developments. Now nobody's inheritance seemed safe. Wild rumors flew that new and unheard-of taxes were going to be imposed, that noblemen were going to be murdered so that the king could seize their estates. And those blank charters were still out there to worry about also. Now, at this moment, with the king out of the country, Henry Bolingbroke landed at Ravenspur in Yorkshire and proclaimed that he was back to claim his rightful inheritance. Now, Yorkshire was a good place to land because the north was in an uproar. I've mentioned before that the north of England is usually a bit rougher. The kings had had to give lords a bit more room to act. But the most powerful family in the north, the Percy family, had been getting especially worried lately that King Richard was planning to supplant them with his own hand-picked men. The two leaders of the Percy family were the Earl of Northumberland and his son Henry, known as Hotspur. And they joined up with Bolingbroke, and they brought their very substantial military retinues with them. And together, the lords marched south. Now, King Richard got the news in Ireland, and immediately sent half his army back to England. But by the time he himself had crossed to Wales, that initial force was melting away in a panic. Bolingbroke sent messengers to tell the king that all he wanted was his rightful inheritance. He wasn't there to claim the throne. Richard agreed to go meet Bolingbroke, but the escort Bolingbroke sent turned into guards, and Richard was never free again. Now, whether Bolingbroke had aimed at deposing the king the whole time, or whether he just seized the moment when it was clear that the king's support was evaporating, we'll never know. And Parliament once again forced the deposition of a king. It was a repeat of what had happened under Edward II, and it had the same result. You can't let an ex-king survive. He's just going to be the focus for rebellion. So Richard was imprisoned in the castle of Pontefract in the north of England, and he probably died there in 1400. The rumor was that he had starved himself to death, and Henry Bolingbroke took the throne as Henry IV, the first of the Lancastrian kings. So what are the lessons of Richard's reign? In many ways, it's a continuation of past conflicts between the king and his barons. Once again, you have the barons taking issue with royal personnel and royal policy. Once again, you see them trying to constrain the king. And once again, this proves impossible. The only way to constrain the king is to remove him. But along the way, we see Parliament playing a much more extensive role. Both sides are trying to use Parliament for their own purposes. And one of the frightening aspects of this development is that you now have judicial murder becoming a fairly standard weapon in English politics. And this is going to continue throughout the rest of the period we're covering in this course and beyond. And the deposition of Richard was much more disruptive than the deposition of Edward II had been. Edward was deposed in favor of his own son, Edward III. Richard had no sons. Henry Bolingbroke was the king's first cousin, but he wasn't the nearest heir to the throne by blood. That would have been the young Edmund Mortimer, Earl of March, the heir to the Earl of March who'd been killed in Ireland. But genealogy had to give way to power politics, and Bolingbroke became king. There was thus a question mark over the legitimacy of the monarchy, and it was going to bedevil English politics for the next century. We're going to watch all of that play out. But first, we're going to pause and talk about what life was like in England in the midst of this great political turmoil.
Lecture 31, Daily Life in the 15th Century.
Welcome back. We ended the last lecture with the deposition and death of Richard II. And we saw that the political climate in England had gotten really toxic. You have noble factions using Parliament in order to attack their rivals, and the result was a level of violence within the inner circle of the powerful that hadn't been seen in England for centuries. The century to come, though, the 15th century, is going to be more of the same, and it's going to get even worse. There would be continued instability at the top, and the war in France would finally sputter to a close without providing any lasting benefits to England. So, in terms of politics and foreign policy, the 15th century was a pretty tough one for England. But for most people in England, it wasn't so bad. It was going to be much, much better than the 14th century had been. That was the century of the Great Famine, and especially of the Black Death. So in this lecture, I'm going to talk a bit about what life was like for all segments of the English population. We'll talk mostly about the English economy, but at the end we're also going to talk about artistic developments. We'll talk about the great age of building in both the towns and the countryside. And we'll see the arrival of the last of the great medieval versions of the Arthur myth. And we'll see how this new version fits in with the way society is changing in the 15th century. So let's start by reviewing a few things we've already talked about with regard to the English economy in the aftermath of the Black Death. This gives us some background for the important trends that we're going to be looking at. You'll remember that the Black Death, of course, led to huge population losses, and this meant peasants were able to bargain for better terms from their landlords. Now they need to compete against other landlords in order to get the most reliable, most productive tenants for their land. Many peasants were able essentially to escape from lordship altogether and become independent farmers. They might lease most of their land or they might own it, but really they're autonomous economic actors. They're in charge of their own fate. And these successful small farmers form the bedrock of what historians call the yeoman class. They're the ones who have enough land not just to support themselves, but to produce for the market.